Welcome to the Manuscript Academy podcast,
brought to you by
a writer
and an agent
who both believe that education is key.
The beauty is the people you meet along the way,
and that community makes all the difference.
Here at the Manuscript Academy, you can learn the skills, make the connections, and have access to experts all from home.
I'm Julie Kingsley.
And I'm Jessica Zinsheimer.
Put down your pens, pause your word counts, and enjoy.
Hi, everyone. We are here with author Nia Davenport. We are so excited for this interview because this is one of those books that has so much happening that you did not see coming. Nia, we're so happy you're here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, this is so fun. So Nia, you have a new book out in the world. It's called Out of Body. Would you like to start with just giving us maybe a little synopsis?
Oh, okay. I like to describe it as Freaky Friday meets Get Out with the warped, eerie vibes of Black Mirror. And basically, there's a 17-year-old girl named Megan. She meets a new bestie over Instagram. They meet up in person and automatically click, but then they're celebrating their three-month anniversary. And without too many spoilers, Megan makes an ill-conceived decision that, like, her best friend kind of coaxes her into. And she wakes up to find that her body has been completely hijacked by her supposed bestie. And there's gaslighting that ensues. And her bestie is like, I don't know what you're talking about. I've always been you, as in wearing your body, and you've always been in my body. So then Megan has to race against a ticking clock to figure out what's going on, figure out shadowy enemies her best friend may or may not have, and figure out how to get her life back.
I love your comps. I love your description. I was wondering how in the world you are going to boil this down, because there is a lot happening in this book. Can you tell us how you came up with the idea and how you mapped it out with your agent? Like, are you a plotter? Are you a pantser? Did it all just magically work out? Or were you like, I had every beat down?
So that answer changes for every book. I'm never a hardcore plotter, like, ever. I've learned to plot better now that I'm selling things on proposal to, like, give, like, my editor a snapshot of this is where I'm going. Not saying I'm going to stick to that, but just an upfront preview. I've always considered myself more so like a headlights writer, though, where I need to know what's going on maybe like 1 to 3 chapters out. I never know, like, the nitty-gritty details. Those twists and turns come as I'm, like, in the manuscript and writing it. And then once I get to the 3 chapters out or so that I've plotted, I have to stop and figure out what the heck is about to happen in, like, the next 3 to 5 chapters.
I love the concept of a headlights writer. That's so perfect. You know, I had clumsily described it as if, what if you are a roller coaster in the dark? And you've got headlights and you can see the next turn, but you have no idea what's after that. But a headlights writer, that's so elegant.
I can't take credit for it. I think I was attending a lecture and that's where I got it from.
Tell us what it feels like to you to be in the headlights. Like, do you look around? Do you see directions? Or does it just unfold as you write?
I always know where the character starts. I know the midpoint drama, and I always know the climax, like, big fight or conflict. I maybe don't know the falling action or the resolution. That's always a little bit hazier. When I'm reading and when I'm drafting, I always have the point of view of sitting in a cinema seat and watching, like, the plot unfold on the big screen. And so literally the action and the dialogue, it's coming to me as I'm watching it and scribbling it down. So, like, sometimes there'll be this moment where I'm, like, staring off into space and it freaks out my family because they're like, you look like you're in a trance. And I'm like, low key, I am in a trance because I'm watching this movie. That's all I can see.
Oh, I love that.
And I've recently learned this is not the same for everyone, writer or reader. My sister, she's an accountant, so she has a very, like, analytical brain. And she was like, yo, what are you talking about? She just reads and, like, inputs the words, but not necessarily, like, the moving cinematic images.
Yeah. I think I feel the same when I'm writing. And I didn't even know that some readers just take in words. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, like an Excel file or something.
Yeah, like, they're not seeing it unfold. You learn something new every day at the Manuscript Academy podcast. I don't know why I didn't know that.
Would you read your first page?
Okay. She can no longer delay the things she dreads. She eases a navy blue duffel bag from under the motel bed, unzips it, and stares down at its contents. The metal case on top is a small, shiny black square, something that might normally contain her charcoal pencils and blending stumps. She wants to shove the bag back under the bed and flee the motel room. She should destroy the case. She should hurl it into a river or a fire or grab a fucking hammer and bash what's inside to pieces. But she can't because she needs it. She needs it even more than the stack of cash buried deeper in the bag. It is time to act. She will not let guilt eat at her. So instead of destroying the case, she snaps it shut and checks that everything she needs is inside. It is. Her phone buzzes, vibrating loudly from its place on the dusty dresser. She abandons the duffel on the carpet, wipes her hands against her jeans. They always feel grimy after she touches the metal case, and grabs the phone.
I think there's so many interesting things that you did here. There's tension. We know that something's going to happen, but you didn't define your character really at all. Can you tell us about that decision and why you kept that kind of air of mystery at the beginning?
So that's not actually the point of view character. The very first two or three pages opens with LC, which is Megan's bestie that then betrays her. And we keep who she is as a mystery to create kind of like an air and like beginning questions of who is this girl? What is she running from? Why does she have these conflicting feelings of like grief, but also anger and also dread? And then she gets the text, and the text is clearly one she's been waiting on, but it doesn't ease any of those negative feelings. It only makes them magnify. And so we created that chapter that way to then get to Megan's first point of view chapter. And we're introduced to a girl named LC. We're not told that she's that voice we heard at the very beginning. But by the end of the chapter, we see the case. We see the duffel bag. We see what's in the case. And then the reader can start making predictions themselves about what underlying sinister elements may or may not be going on.
Well, it's so cool because you're doing something that feels to me almost like advanced calculus in terms of making this work, because you've got characters who are going into other bodies, and you also have to figure out how to make point of view work. Can you talk about how you did that?
Lots of mapping notes about, okay, this character is in this body. There was also lots of like, let me hit the delete backspace because I just wrote this dialogue as if Megan is in her real body, but she's not in her real body. She's in someone else's body. So whoever is talking to her should be talking to her as if she's this other person and not herself. So it was lots of mental calculus and gymnastics to keep everything straight. But as far as voice goes, that was one of the themes I wanted to come out. Regardless of if Megan is wearing her real skin or someone else's, part of her journey is to figure out that whoever she is at the core never changes with her outer shell. And it's part of her learning to be confident in who she is and embrace herself and stop trying on friends like outfits to find her own identity, to know that it was a thing inside of her all along, rooted in her likes and dislikes and dreams and beliefs. She ends up learning that you kind of have to turn inward to be like, this is fundamentally me. And so it was very easy for Megan's voice not to shift regardless of whose body I dropped her in, because I was very focused on making sure all of the terrific things and even the insecurities about Megan came out like loud and strongly, regardless of the outer shell that she wore.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. How did you know you wanted to be a writer? And what did you start writing first?
According to my family, I've always been a writer. And I think I've always loved it, and I've always been very like passionate about it. I don't think I decided I wanted to try writing as a career until right when I was about to graduate college. A really good friend handed me L.A. Banks's Vampire Huntress Legends, and I'm a huge paranormal fantasy fan. And it was one of the first times I saw a Black girl in a fantasy book, and it smacked me in the face with the realization that should have been like a duh, but was like, I can do this too. It's not some mystical career path that's closed off. And so from that point forward, I remember voraciously looking for more fantasy and paranormal stories that had BIPOC characters. And I came to a point where I was like, I want to contribute to the conversation.
Yeah. And publishing is like, yeah, we are a little magical. No, you probably can't do this. Like, they definitely have this way of making it harder than it needs to be to see that people can, if they put in the work, make it happen.
So what was your publishing journey like? Querying, getting an agent? Tell us the dirty details.
Okay, I will. Dirty details, mortifying stories and all. So Katie Flum at Liza Dawson Associates is my agent. I was a biology major and a theater arts minor. And like I said, writing was something I always wanted to do, but I came very much from a family that it was like, you must be a doctor or choose another career path that makes like a suitable amount of income. So when I graduated, I ended up teaching. And I want to say it was like a settling career path because I've learned so much as a writer, especially writing adult crossover and the YA books, just from the 7 years I spent with teens in the classrooms, studying literature and picking it apart from educators' perspective and seeing how like young people pick it apart from their perspective too. So I taught English and biology for 7 years. And while I was doing that, I was like, I'm about to drop money on a MacBook Air. And I was like, I'm going to buy one and it's going to be my motivation to actually start working on a novel and seriously pursuing the path of traditional publishing. Okay, I knew nothing about publishing and the process of querying and getting an agent and all of that. I remember one of my first queries was for an unfinished manuscript. Looking back on it, I'm like, oh, why? So I very much, my process was learning by doing and attending several writing workshops and writing seminars. So I just soaked up a ton of craft things when I could afford to do it in person. And then just from like a lot of Googling on the internet and just looking at like things like Query Tracker and Manuscript Academy. So I shelved that half drafted book. It still sits on my laptop, half drafted. And then I had this idea for this YA Hades and Persephone retelling that I queried, and my now agent, she offered me a revise and resubmit. It was, again, me learning as I go. The first chapter, I remember it was opening with this girl describing herself in the mirror. And my agent, Katie, was like, I love the story. I love the premise. I love the character. But can we work on the first chapter? And can we work on pulling her motivation through the entire story? So I spent about 3 to 5 months. I revised it. And then I was at a writing retreat. And a really good friend was like, hit send on the R&R. Stop just letting it sit there and anguish. Just hits in. So I hits in. And then about 2 months later, I didn't see my offer email from my agent until a good friend shares my same agent. And she texted me, was like, check your email. And I was like, oh my God. So that was that. It's a story of my heart, but it's also another shelf book because we sent it out on submission to editors, but we got a lot of responses. Like it just wouldn't stand out in the YA market as it currently was. So I started working on The Blood Trials, which is the book I eventually sold. It's a science fantasy that combines like futuristic tech with epic myth and magic. And I wrote it purposely in this crossover vein to approach character arcs and things from kind of like an adult category perspective, but also still have, I guess, the high-paced plot structure that I really love and still love about YA. And that is my book that we sold it in 2020. It didn't come out till 2022. Its sequel came out in 2023, and then we get to Out of Body, which is my YA. I have always very much been a type of writer that I kind of defy the whatever the general advice or norm is. Like I know the general advice, and I feel like it may be transitioning out, is to stay in one genre or one category first and then like branch out. But publishing is not so nice to us writers sometimes with like advances and being able to write for a living. And just on top of all of the money things, I was like, I love adult as much as I love YA. And I truly want to be able to create a career in both. Out of Body is my YA debut, but it came to me via a book package or project in collaboration with Dovetail Working Partners. Katie got the premise and she sent it over to me and was like, what do you think about this? Do you want to send in like a first chapter as a sample audition? And I immediately connected with the premise of Out of Body because Megan is very much like I was as a teen. She is the introvert who's a secret extrovert who is like longing for a place to belong. I remember as a teen being like, my life is really dull. Am I the only one existing in this dull little bubble? And just like seeking more like thrilling adventures. And that's one of Megan's driving motivations for her to make some of the choices, the good and the bad ones. So when I saw that aspect of the character, it's a project that I immediately wanted to be a part of.
Can you tell us about, because we love Katie so very much, can you tell us about the conversations you had early on so you knew that she was the one who was right for you?
Yes. Okay. I will admit to like a wee bit of Twitter stalking. Okay. When I got ready to quarry, I found Katie because I remember like researching a bunch of YA agents and the books that she loved. I think one of the books on her website that she really liked was Lainey Taylor's Daughters of Smoke and Bone. I was like, oh, we like all of the same books. And I was like, I feel like our styles might align because I'm very much a writer who I write the things I love to read. So I had already sent her a query, but then I was also signed up to attend a writing workshop. And I happened to see Corey was one of the participating agents. So I was like, oh, I'll sign up for a query critique just to say hey and meet her in person. So I did. And when I got there, she was like, I've already read, you know, your query that you sent before this. I love it. Here are the things I would love to see done differently or tweaked if you agree with them. And then the rest was kind of like history. But working with Katie has been phenomenal because when she called to make her offer, it was very much, she got the book. It's really something special when your agent or editor collaborator just gets the story and gets like your overall vision. Yeah. So this is why, and this is publishing. So it can be very hard to take a trope that feels well-worn and drop a Black girl in it and have someone see the value of that well-worn trope as being something entirely fresh and new simply and or solely because you've placed a person of a marginalized or underrepresented population within that well-worn trope. And it was one of the things I loved most about Katie and that made me know she'd be a champion for the types of stories I want to tell because she automatically got it and just adored that approach that I was taking to just the overall stories that I endeavored to tell.
So what advice do you have for other writers who are about to do this big, scary, complicated process? What are some things you wish you knew?
I wish I knew to breathe, and that sounds so simple, but I wish I knew to breathe and to take it one day at a time. And you hear the advice that publishing is not a race, even though it definitely can sometimes feel like it is, especially when you're in the Twitter, Instagram, social media microcosm of publishing where you're seeing all these cool, like, I got an agent, I sold a book, I sold film rights announcements, but breathe and take it slow. Just because it's not a race. And just like for me and my process, the way I approached it was I'm going to just grind and diligently keep perfecting my craft. And if this one thing does not pan out, I'm going to throw something else out there and play like a statistics game. Like the more I put myself out there, the higher the probability of getting a yes amidst what can sometimes seem like a sea of no's.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of those things where you have to do your very best and keep trying. Do all your research, keep trying. And some of it is out of your control, but you absolutely can increase your odds.
I felt like you did such an amazing job of grounding. So like, tell us about how you created a status quo between Megan and Elsie, and then how you, you know, pulled that switch and how you knew the timing to do it right. Like, how did you know it needed just that amount?
So the very first chapter that we see them both together, I wanted the status quo to feel a little bit like a empowered balance between one girl who Megan isn't necessarily a pushover, but she's very sweet. She's very kind. In many ways, she's very naive and I guess not coddled, but she's had the safety net of growing up in a loving home and a loving family and parents who genuinely look after her that LC has never had. So Megan is also very privileged in that respect. But the power imbalance is there because I hope you can kind of see a little bit of hero worship between Megan and LC. Like Megan is like, here's the epitome of what I want to be. We're besties, but I've latched onto her as a bestie because we clicked so well. And I want to live up to LC's expectations and be, I'm sorry, I thought I, that's Katie texting me right now with news that I've been waiting on.
Okay, so we can't give all of you out there any details yet, but while we were on the Zoom call, Nia got an offer for her fourth book, and we're so excited. Congratulations, Nia.
I know. My heart is pumping for you. I literally feel like I got a deal. I'm like, oh, so happy.
Okay, I think you were talking about how Megan relates to LC.
Yeah, so they're equals in that they can hold their own with each other. And their friendship is a genuine one without giving too much away. Like the bond and deep connection that they feel is not just one-sided. It's genuine. And the point of Elsie's character is that even though she feels this genuine bond, which connects to that grief and dread we saw at the beginning, she has to do this horrific thing for reasons to make sure she stays safe. And that's like the part of the mystery thriller. So even though she doesn't want to, Elsie is kind of the anti-hero that chooses to do things selfishly for herself, but for reasons that are driven by survival. So we see Megan and her hero worship, but also feeling legitimately bonded to LC. And then we also see LC who relates to Megan as in she's kind of like coaxing and manipulating her throughout the scene. But then we get that final beat and Megan sees that like LC looks hollow or dead inside. And the subtext there, she looks dead or hollow because she knows this terrible thing that she's forcing herself to do. And it kind of like robs LC of a piece of herself too, once she does it to Megan.
We would love to give out a copy of your book. Could you give us a secret word and the first person who emails it to us, we'll send them a copy?
Can it be like two words that make up a word?
Sure, sure.
Sailor Moon.
Okay, so the first person to email academy@manuscriptwishlist.com with Sailor Moon in the subject line will get a copy of this book.
Yeah, without giving away anything, can you talk about how you built new technologies or new ideas around technological advances just so casually?
Full disclosure, that is the fantasy, that is the science fiction fantasy girl in me, because I am not a science fiction fantasy writer that plays by hardcore rules. And I'm like, these are the rules of magic or these are the rules of tech. I am very much that writer who's like, it's my world. I make the rules. Why do I need to bother like staying within these rigidly defined conventions of magic rules? Is literally my world. I get to make the rules. So I very much play with the reader as far as, is this switch the result of magic or is it the result of tech? And that's part of the thriller mystery throughout the book. And I built the technology very much, it was inspired by Altered Carbon. To where
you okay, have bio major.
Yes. I know, I was thinking that too.
Yes. In most of my books, when there's even magic or technology or even hereditary gifts or powers, you get some level of biology explanation. Either it's based on Mendelian genetics and it's hereditary, or it's based on like neuroscience and uploading and downloading information via neurons in the brain. So in Out of Body, the technology is based on what a near future society would look like when you could move your personhood to a brand new body.
That's so interesting. I mean, there's so much here that has ethical implications, emotional implications, and It's almost as if because you took Megan out of the context she's used to, and you made it so that suddenly she was unwelcome in the home she grew up in. She was unwelcome to her parents. I mean, the way her father is saying, leave or I'm calling the police. My goodness. Like that just, you know, that she's outside and her childhood friend is like, what are you doing? Get out. You know, to have that sense of alienation in the place that should feel the most like home, I thought was such an interesting way to start off the adventure for your character.
So I started off that way because Megan is seeking that sense of thriller adventure or like that cool factor because she thinks she's boring, her life is boring, the place that is home. She's this suburban girl who goes to this suburban school. And this is a little bit autobiographical because I remember feeling like the supposed monotony of the suburbs. And I was like, it's boring where I live. So it's like shaking her world so she can see that she took for granted the things that really make life precious. She kind of like shrugged them off as being dull and like chasing after something else. So when she gets that adventure, it's not the adventure that she had in mind. And it shakes her to her core when she's entirely yanked out of the environment. And to get her there, I really thought about, I'm very, very close with my family. My family is very much like my rock and my support system and my refuge. And I've been fortunate to where they have been my entire life. So when I was writing those scenes, I was thinking about how would I feel if something occurred where my family looked at me like a complete stranger and treated me in that manner. And not even just saying, I don't know you, but turning anger and like distrust towards Megan. And like the dad saying, you need to leave my house before I call the cops. And Megan being like, what do you mean? Like just freaking out. Like, this is my house. You are my parents.
And that he was willing to risk her getting hurt.
Well, yeah. It doesn't surprise me at all that you were a teacher. Because when I actually gave this some thought and I was like, well, what would happen if I went to Jessica's body? What happens if she was here with my crazy kids, you know, or whatever, you know, like whose body would you want to be in? And then it just starts this incredible conversation in a classroom setting about perception and things aren't always better in someone else's shoes. And exactly. And if we all, I mean, as an entire community of Americans, we could all use a little of this, you know? So I think it's
for empathy.
That's why stories like this are so effective, you know? And when I taught college, like going into the spookiness of like Black Mirror and taking like a concept from childhood and playing around with it in a deeper way is really interesting. I'm there for the conversations. Have you had conversations with kids about this? How are the kids reacting?
I have. So the current generation, they are phenomenal. And they're phenomenal because they have the tools and the ability and the incredible like brilliance to have these types of conversations about socio-emotional health that I feel like maybe my generation just did not have that wherewithal. And I think it's one of the pros of social media. I mean, there's a lot of cons for social media and like kids and how it may or may not inform themselves. But one of the pros is that if they're seeking it out, there are some phenomenal like YouTubers and TikTokers that I've seen my own kids watch. I have a 14 and an 11 year old, and I've seen my own kid watch where they talk about bias and the need for diversity and just like deconstructing internal biases and just all these incredible things. And so I think kids are aware of all of the themes that I play with, as you stated, in out of body, and they're already having these conversations among themselves. And I can see them making the connections and really, as great as this generation is, no generation is without bullying and just like nastiness or meanness. And so it makes me feel really great when they can say things like, I don't know what my peer may be going through, or we should be more sensitive to those we go to school with because we don't know. I taught for 5 years at an all-boys college prep school in inner city Houston, and one of the things that amazed me from that environment was how much care the boys took with each other's feelings. Even when like everybody had like their differences and their own like individual set of socio economic or lifestyle circumstances or just whatever. But I didn't come across much of any instances where students were like being cruel to their peers because of their identities or who they were. And it was more so instances where students were like really protective of one another. And when like conflicts were going on, the kids that you would least expect were the ones that would kind of step in and be like, yo, chill out. This is not okay.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
I love that. You know, I like kids are the best. They're going to take over. It's going to be awesome.
So one thing I would like to talk about, at least for me as a reader, I think the best speculative works also have that layer of the typical teen stuff going on too. And there was a moment when all of this came together for me. We have Megan in another girl's body hanging out with her childhood best friend, Ryan. And he knows she's had a terrible day. And he brings her all the candy. And there's this moment where she says, "This is the first time a boy has given me a gift, and it's in someone else's body." Can you talk more about that?
I love that scene. I know the book itself is not about the crush vibes, but it's one of my favorite scenes in the book for exactly what you said, that it kind of like takes a moment to really root the reader in the typical teen or like an authentic teen experience. And so, like I said, Megan is very much a girl who grows up wanting a boyfriend, wanting a crush, or wanting to go to parties and wanting to hang out with a cool friend crowd. So like the things that like the typical teen would see if watching, like, I don't know, The Vampire Diaries or Blood and Water or, you know, some teen show. I watch them all. They're all my jam. But and be like, oh, my life is not like that. And I want this. And so Megan has never had a boyfriend before. She's had a crush, but Megan is very much the type of person who wouldn't be vocal about it. And so she meets Ryan and she's in someone else's body, but she instantly likes him. I think there's even a moment where she's like, feels silly and shallow and absurd because she's like, why am I even going down this crush path when I'm literally in someone else's body in the midst of this horrendous mystery? But Megan and Ryan, they really like click from the beginning, and you see that they hit it off and that Ryan doesn't know Megan is not his friend at first. Ryan is just being like a really good supportive friend. But then Ryan, he's a smart kid. So they figure it out. And that scene comes once Ryan already knows Megan is in someone else's body. And he brings her the candy, knowing she's had a rough day because of this ordeal, and trying to do something nice to lift her spirits. And Megan receives it as that gesture. And she's even like has this moment like, is he just being nice or is he crushing on me the way I'm crushing on him? And is that why he brought me candy? Is it more than just being a good friend? And so it was one of those like really gooey, warm, fun moments too, right? Just to like dive into the wonder and the feels of like a first crush and the giddiness you feel when you're like, I like this person and this person may like me back.
Well, I love that he says that she is more mature now, that she has more emotional regulation, that she has done some growth. And I thought that was so interesting too, because it's almost as if who she is in this other body took the relationship from purely platonic as the girl she's inhabiting was growing up to something a little bit more because of who she is.
Yeah. And that was by design too, because that was one of the things I wanted to like kind of like draw a clear line for the reader, that Ryan is attracted to Megan because of who Megan is on the inside, not attracted to the outer exterior of the girl that he's always known. And it's a question that Megan has too. And Megan clarifies it for herself because of things like that, that Ryan says, that he is recognizing the market difference between Megan and the girl whose body she's in. And on page, you can see him expressing that he's seen the changes and that like he's finding himself crushing on the girl that he's just now met.
So one thing I'd love to talk about is how you regulate tension in the book, because she tries so many times to say things that only she would know, but no one believes her for so long. And when someone finally believes her, and by extension, Ryan does too, That to me was just a huge, oh, thank God. So can you talk about the decision to like leave her so very alone for so long?
Yeah. So I feel like it's just something that naturally developed. There's definitely a theme of gaslighting. Like that's a word that it's always been a word, but it's a word that I feel like the current generation of young people are very familiar with and they use it. And I love that they call each other and even adults in their lives out on it. And so we definitely put a thread of that in to where at the beginning, Megan is like, I am Megan Allen. Like I live in this address. I think she tells her parents about a piano that her dad and uncle helped move into the house. She gets to her childhood best friend and she's talking about how they used to cosplay and make costumes and Sailor Moon. And even the friend is like, you told LC this. And now LC is standing in front of me, like playing some cruel joke. And then so there's a stretch where nobody believes her and she feels completely isolated. And I hope the larger function of the isolation served for Megan to learn her inner strength and learn that she doesn't need to rely on friends around her to feel fierce or to feel bold or to feel invincible or to feel like she matters and like she's shining brightly and fiercely. That's something that she's capable of seizing all on her own.
And it's so interesting too. There were two moments I can think of where she kind of tests the adults around her when she's in this new body to see how safe they are. Or the adults just show their willingness to believe her to some extent, not to the, you know, the full, oh yes, you're someone else in this body extent. But the social worker said she would believe her over the police for her account mm-hmm. of what happened. I thought that was such a great example of an adult being responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And also the moment when she goes to the parents of the girl whose body she's inhabiting and says, I'm vegan now. And she says, let's see how they react to see what kind of parents they are.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was so interesting how she is navigating all of these things to kind of like test the safety of the people around her.
Yeah. And I felt like it adds another layer of tension and conflict because with each test, it's always like they could do the decent, responsible adult thing, or they could do the indecent, terrible, damaging adult thing. And we never know which path the adults are going to go that Megan is continuously testing for, like throughout the book.
Yeah, I think teenagers are so aware of the fact that adults don't always do the right thing. And yeah, I just thought it was really interesting and important the way that you put that in there because she is in such a vulnerable position. And I almost, as an adult now, almost forgot how when I was that age, I was like, I don't trust adults at all. Yeah.
So it's hard for me to forget. And I guess one of the reasons why it's in there so strongly is because the world is wild and horrific things happen. So my own kids, they're always like, mom, chill. And I'm always like, I don't trust adults at all, especially with young adults and children who are in extremely vulnerable positions when they're with adults. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But we've seen more than they have.
Yeah.
I feel like there's more to say about identity versus physical body. Do you have more to say on that topic? Because I feel like there are just so many things, so many directions we could go under that category.
Megan embodies that theme of identity first versus physical body, but so does LC, which is the best friend that hijacks her body, because we only get LC's perspective from interstitials. But when we get them, we definitely see LC grappling with this question of, am I a monster? Am I the villain? Am I absolved because I did this out of survival? And we see her hopping from Megan's body, and then this isn't the first time she's done it. And we see that once we figure out why she's able to do this and what's been done to her related to this, there's a whole nother layer of identity as far as like co-opting the bodies of girls and women in particular, and sometimes Black and other BIPOC girls being in a position where, like, simply because they're Black, society doesn't put as much weight on, like, their protection or their safety or care as much. I mean, California specifically created an alert for Black children that are abducted or, you know, assumed abducted because of how widely it goes unacknowledged or unrecognized or just shrugged off. It's called the Ebony Alert that California and just went into effect January 1. It's not a heavy theme that comes out, but there's definitely a layer where Megan is trying to figure out, is she going to hate Elsie and get revenge or like just kind of like leave her to this horrific fate, or if she's going to make a different choice that saves herself and someone else. And part of Megan's like ability and decision to make the choice that she does is recognizing sometimes society is not kind to Black girls, and that their safety and community and power in numbers when you choose to be kind to someone you see that's at risk. And that's a message I hope that transcends like race and like ethnicity, and that I just hope any young reader can get like, the world is cruel enough. So if you are faced with the choice between adding on that cruelty or being kind or compassionate or even like extending a helping hand, like just considering the choice that empowers you as well as empowers someone else.
Well, community keeps us safe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still kind of processing the California law. I hadn't heard about it here in Maine. And I'm thinking, once again, just getting political about West Virginia. They're talking about a new bill that will, you know, turn books into felonies with librarians. And I think if we don't have stories like this that really dig into culture and stakes, then what do we have? You know, that this is why we write, this is why we read, and this is why children should have books like this. In a world where things feel a little bit out of control, what's your best tips for writer to write about difficult subjects?
So honestly, my best tip is to write what you love and write what makes you happy. I spent a lot of time between my first YA not being bought and like the angst of seeing if the blood trials would sell, bawling back and forth between writing what makes me happy and what I love and trying to like mystically predict what editors would buy and writing to what was trendy or what seemed to be like on like trend. And one of the things that I just eventually arrived at was it's so out of our control as like writers, like what gets bought or what doesn't, or what like gets offered rep or what doesn't, or what hits a list or what doesn't, or what sells X number of units. And for the most part, I feel like there really is no true rhyme or reason. And I just came to a point where I was like, if it feels like a roll of the die either way, then I'd rather stick to writing what I'm passionate about and what brings me joy and the types of stories that I can just fall in love with the plots and the worlds and the characters and see where they land versus trying to fit into this trendy box and still feeling like I'm just throwing paint at a wall to see what sticks.
No, I know what you mean. It's so strange because a lot of the times people in publishing come up with these rules like blank doesn't sell, or this kind of book has to do X, Y, and Z. Do we know for sure? No, of course not. And there are so many things where I'm like, if you could just get this to the readers, it would be great. But unfortunately, we have to go through, you know, so many people with so many rules who, you know, kind of repeat the rules to each person that they meet along the way. And I think you're absolutely right. Write what you love, even if you think that there's some rule against it, because the rules are always changing. And something that we're saying, oh, that's not possible in traditional publishing. They want it to be just this one specific thing. Nothing outside of that works. All of that's changing all the time. It's just changing so slowly that you can't watch it change in real time.
For sure.
Do you have any tips for the writers out there who just don't feel included by traditional publishing?
So I feel like I've struggled with this throughout my career at various points. But one thing, and I don't like giving like one size fits all advice because, you know, it's so subjective and just dependent on the individual person and their like unique needs and situations and like preferences. But for me, it was super helpful to find a writing community of like critique partners and beta readers and like friends to where that was a space that I felt like I fit in within larger traditional publishing. So even if I felt like I was floundering within like the larger, more general space, I had my writers group and I knew that we were in community and it was a space to commiserate and like share wins and share passes and like fears and anxieties and just everything. And finding that group of people that I felt like we were going like on the same, not like path, but like we were in the thick of it together and leaning on each other, that made all the difference. It clicked when I stopped worrying about what traditional publishing like gatekeepers and the likes would feel or think about the stories and characters and the voices that I was writing. And it was when The Blood Trials was publishing and it's found an incredible community of readers and just all of the outpouring of like support and like love and just like enthusiasm for The Blood Trials and its main character, Akenna, it really made me see that like there's always space for your voice out there because there's always readers who need it, who are eager for it, and who are like literally scouring for more of those same voices.
So what's your number one tip for writers?
Ooh, okay. My number one tip for writers, this is going to sound so overworn and cliche, but it helps, is to read widely and read a lot. There's been so many times where I've been like stuck as far as like character work or like world building or plot or setting, and not just read, but like just consume media from books to TV to podcasts, to movies, to songs, to whatever. There's been so many times where I've hit up against a block and just consuming a book or a story or a TV show or a movie has jiggled whatever free within the creative spaces in my brain to be like, oh, enemies to lovers is a perfect trope for this book. Let's figure out how to weave that in.
I'm convinced that we're absorbing energy like vitamins from the things we consume.
Yeah.
I love that. That's terrific. And I do think when you consume something and then there's like a fresh air or like water component, it's like you consume something and you go for a walk and then suddenly your own idea kind of comes out of it all. Yes. I'm like, yeah. Oh, hi, there you are. I've been waiting for you.
Yeah. It's like you have to feed your brain and then go do something else.
Yeah. It's been a learning process, but I went from having those blocks and just like determinedly sitting at my laptop or like being like, I'm going to push through it and just getting stonewalled and going nowhere to the times where I've been so exhausted that I've had to just step away. It always comes that when I just like relax and go consume something and then go for that walk or take that shower or I'm driving the kids around. That's it. So it took an embarrassing longer amount of time for that to happen before I was like, next time you are feeling like you're at a wall, you should really just take a breath and step away instead of being like, no, I'm going to plow through this wall. Now I've learned to recognize it and actually seize the value in like just getting up and going to
watch. Or suddenly your house is so clean. You're like, would you like to see my drawers?
It's just, it's kind of counterintuitive, right? That it would actually be faster to go do something else and your brain will be working on it in the background. Do you have an example of a time that happened when you were writing this book?
When I was writing Out of Body, I feel like one of the instances is when I was trying to figure out how to bring the conflict to like its climax towards the end. And there were several different paths that it could take, but it was a path where it needed to be believable. It needed to seem authentic and it needed to keep Megan to stand in the role, in like that heroic role. And like, there's a villain, I'm not gonna say who, but there's a clear villain. And I wanted that person to clearly be cast in that villain light. There was a moment where I had to figure out how far Megan would go to get her life back without jumping over this line of villainy herself, because that's definitely one of the issues that LC struggles with throughout the book too. And at first I was like, I'm not sure how to do it. I don't know how to like make Megan defeat the villain or overcome the villain and still have her and this other character stand in the light too. And so it was a time that I just had to like take a breath and get up. And that was when like season two of Blood and Water, which is this fantastic Netflix show that's this twisty thriller mystery. And so I watched it and I went on a jog and I was like, a lot of things jiggle free in my jog. So I was like on my jog and I had to like slow to a brisk walk to grab my phone and be like, I know how to do it.
I love that.
I like jiggle free in my brain. That's like my favorite. Like it was in there all along, but I just had to move it and it just fell off. I don't know. It's just like jiggling around.
Yeah. Well, like you right have to there. Move you to move yeah. your brain.
That's mm-hmm. awesome.
That is so cool. Mia, this was such a pleasure. This is such an ambitious, fun, beautiful work. And I'm happy it exists. I'm so happy you. For your good news. This is like for you, for Katie, for the world. We are happy.
Yeah, it's amazing. Thank you. I was like, I do wish we had champagne.
I wish we could pass champagne through the screen.
It's funny how things come full circle because I remember like movie writer like attending like the Manuscript Academy like workshops and offerings and then sitting on like this call and getting like the offer about a brand new book. I'm like,
you know what it is? Aww. I think it's like writer energy. The more writers, like it's just there's something about it. I think all of this stuff is just mystical and interesting and amazing. So just like, where can the writers find you online?
Too many places.
I know.
For as long as that sinking ship is still there, I am on Twitter. I refuse to call it by the other name, but I am on Twitter at Nia_Davenport. I am on Instagram at Nia.Davenport. I'm on TikTok making probably embarrassing, mortifying videos at Nia Davenport. My website is also www.nedavenport.com.
Yay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We are so glad that you joined us. And as always, we appreciate your feedback. Just head on over to the iTunes store and let us know what you think. It not only helps us make this podcast be the best it can be, but it also affects our ratings within the iTunes platform.
We'd love to hear from you. If you're feeling brave and want to submit your page for our First Pages podcast, you can send it to academy@manuscriptwishlist.com with First Pages podcast in the subject line. We'd also just love to hear from you.
And if you'd like to learn more about the Manuscript Academy and everything we have to offer,